This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. 5 times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's talk now about some architecture, Dahlin in New Orleans. This lady was on to talk about why buildings were collapsing, and it made me think about the story of architecture in New Orleans, and I think it's an amazing one. Danielle Del Sol joins us, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. Good morning, Danielle. How are you?
Good morning. I'm great. How are you?
I am great. Thank you. Tell me, for the audience, to refresh your memory, what we were talking about last time you were on.
Yeah, so we were talking about historic buildings and the need to keep them well-maintained because they're old and, you know, they were built with fantastic materials. That's why they've lasted 100, 150, maybe even 200 years. But we can't take that for granted. We always have to check up on our wood and our brick because when buildings are neglected, they fall down.
And that's not good.
No, it's not. It's dangerous. And unfortunately, we have a lot of blight in the city. We do have people who don't take care of their buildings. Maybe they don't even live in New Orleans. A building has been empty, and that affects a whole block. It affects a whole neighborhood when people don't take care of their property.
I think it's amazing how we take for granted the architecture of the city and so many things that are around us, and sometimes, in a way, because there is blight, we wish that we lived in a city that was more, I hate to say cosmopolitan, but you know, like, yeah, you can go to, what's the city in Florida where people go seaside? Yeah, it's nice, but there's no real character to it or anything. It's nice and neat, but do you really want to live there? Let's talk about some of the specific architecture, and I wanted to start with shotgun houses because the history of it, I would love, Danielle, to have a piece of ground and build a big piece of ground with a beautiful brand new shotgun house on it. How did that all get started here in New Orleans?
Shotgun houses are extremely practical. So they really started as a working class form of architecture, and you know, they were affordable, and they were also an affordable way to live with multi-generations. So if you have a double shotgun, you have two units. You know, other places in the country, that's called a duplex. We call it a double. You could have, you know, the grandma or the aunt and uncles on one side, and you live on the other side. Or you could rent it out and pay your mortgage with the rental income from the other side. So, but they were an economical housing form. So no hallways, typically. You just go from room to room. And they were called shotguns because the doorways lined up, and you could literally fire off a shotgun, and the pellets would go from one end of the house all the way through out the back.
Is that a uniquely New Orleans thing, a shotgun house? Because that's, somebody texted that in. By the way, I want to welcome the audience in at 504-260-1870. If you have any questions about the history of New Orleans architecture, maybe architecture, that's how I'll say it. If you have any questions about maybe what's a myth, what's true, what's not, Danielle will clear it up for us, 504-260-1870. And the first question somebody texted in is, were shotgun houses a New Orleans product, or was that imported from somewhere else? What's the history of the, quote, shotgun house, as you just said, because you could fire a shotgun from front door through the back door, right?
Right. The history is a bit contested. A lot of people believe that it is a an African building form that came by way of Haiti and the other Caribbean islands. So either enslaved people brought this building type, or free people of color coming from Haiti could have also contributed. But We have more shotgun houses than anywhere probably in the world, certainly in the United States. You'll find a smattering of shotgun houses in Texas or in other places, maybe even in neighborhood. You know, you might go to Nashville or Atlanta and see some historic neighborhoods. Maybe you'll find a shotgun house. Maybe, I'm sure there's some in Mobile, plenty in Mobile.
Maybe Charleston, possibly?
Yeah, maybe Charleston, but no one has shotguns like we have. And I'll tell you, the Uptown National Register Historic District is the largest National Register District in the country. For those of you who don't know, the National Register of Historic Places is the kind of the directory of all the most historic places in the country. Uptown is a National Register District. We have 24 here in New Orleans. And fully one-third of the buildings in Uptown are shotgun houses. So over 18,000 historic structures in Uptown, over a third are historic shotguns. You're not going to find that anywhere else in the country. And you're right, we take it for granted, but we shouldn't, because it's really a special thing.
Is there something intrinsic to New Orleans that made shotgun houses attractive? And let me take a step back and talk about what is the traditional shotgun house, if I'm looking at it from above or walking through it?
Mm-hmm. It's a narrow rectangle, essentially, where you can, you know, there's, you go from room to room. You may start in a living room, go through a dining room, then you have a bedroom. You're just walking straight back. And then in the back, you're going to have a kitchen. That's kind of the old school way. Now, people have customized them through the years. And the thing that's been really special about shotguns and the reason they've proliferated is because they're so customizable. You can have a single shotgun. You can have a double shotgun. You can have a camelback. You can have a side hall. You can have any sort of variation. And then the shotgun is the building form. You can decorate it any way you want. On the front, you can have a Greek Revival look with, you know, boxy columns. Or you can have Italianate with fanciful brackets. You know, people got really creative. You can have arts and crafts style, where it almost looks like it belongs in California. But one thing I'll tell you is, we have, you know, these buildings were built to correspond with the climate. We had transoms above these doorways that line up. And if you want privacy, you keep your doors closed, you open those transoms, and because all those doorways line up, you have a cool breeze that comes through that house. Remember, these were built before air conditioning, so you had to have that cool breeze to survive in the summer. But you also have a front porch for commiserating with your neighbors, saying hello. And that is something that new places like Seaside have completely copied. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the buildings might be new, but they've taken all the best elements of New Orleans architecture and other historic architecture from across the country and brought it back. And that's why people love it.
Yeah, I'm not trying to be negative, but they're faking the funk, Danielle, and you know they are. They're faking the funk. Somebody texts in, allows any breeze to travel straight through. I can remember going to visit family members where they would have the front of the house of the shotgun house was a bedroom, and you would walk in, and that would be somebody's bedroom. Was that common, or do you know how they were pretty well laid out, how the shotgun houses were laid out?
Typically, the front room was more of a living room, mm-hmm. Because it does correspond with the street. And then the bedroom would be more in the middle of the house. But, you know, people would just, because you're piling so many people into these houses sometimes, you just kind of switch them around as you need to. And then in modern times, of course, we have people adding on hallways or, you know, subdividing rooms to create hallways so that you don't have to walk through bedrooms, because that's really not a way we like to live in modern day.
Yeah, I remember a kid walking in a shotgun house or a hunter's house in Gretna, and there was Uncle Claude in his athletic shirt, whatever you call those shirts, you know, without the sleeves, in his bed. And I, even at seven, I thought that was kind of odd, but, well, you know, whatever. Somebody texted in and wants to know, why do we paint the ceilings of our porches light blue? Is that
a
thing?
Yeah, so that is very much a thing. And there's different variations depending on what paint company you use on what the exact blue is. Mm-hmm. But people call it Haint blue. It's a beautiful light sky blue. And there's two explanations, and either both are right or one is right. I don't know. You can pick or choose which one you like best. But the first, it comes from African traditions, and we see this in the Gullah Geechee people from South Carolina, the enslaved people who were brought there and then settled there, that haints or spirits, bad spirits, they didn't want them to congregate around the house. And so they put the sky blue color so that the haints would just keep flying, fly away, thinking that was the sky. So that is one theory, and that's why it's called Haint Blue. The other theory is more practical, which is that insects or wasps, you know, things that build nests will think that that is the sky because it's the same color, and they will not build a nest there. Now, I'm not going to tell you whether or not a wasp can see color or not. So I don't know the validity of that theory. But those are the two thoughts behind why we choose that beautiful sky blue and why it's so ubiquitous across the city.
Somebody texts in, called it mud dauber blue. I will tell you this. I don't know about if wasps can see color or not, but Danielle, before you ever use any of this wasp spray, make sure you test fire it. Because there's nothing worse.
Oh, gosh.
There's nothing worse than going in half cocked, where you let go a little bit with the trigger, and there's not enough backup, and all you do is anger them. You don't want that to happen at all. Let me take a break. We'll pick it up.
No, that sounds very scary.
We come back. We're having a fun hour talking to Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center of New Orleans. If there are any houses in New Orleans that you wondered about, there's one on Carrollton Avenue that always got my attention that would appear to be Asian in influence, and it just seemed to stand out to me. I don't know why that was there. Somebody else texted in and said, thought that the property tax was charged by the width of the property. That's why they built shotgun houses, narrow with long length. I'm sure there's a story for each and every shotgun house and everything you see in the city. We'll talk about camelbacks and more when we return. If you have any questions or comments, 504-260-1870. Talking about the architecture of New Orleans when we come back on WWL. It is 9:25. We talk about so many serious, heavy topics here. We thought we'd take an hour on a beautiful spring morning and just appreciate everything that's around us with the architecture of the city. We're talking to Danielle Del Sol, our friend, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center, New Orleans. Danielle, before we move on to camelbacks and more, tell me about the Preservation Resource Center.
So we are a 50-year-old nonprofit dedicating to preserving and revitalizing New Orleans historic architecture and neighborhoods and cultural identity. So, you know, back to what you were saying before, Tommy, we kind of take this historic landscape that we have for granted, but we shouldn't. It is completely unique in the country. I'll tell you, we had a conference of over 1,000 architects that came, and people who came from across the country in October, and they were just floored. People kept coming up to me saying, I cannot believe how much beautiful architecture New Orleans has. These incredible neighborhoods are walkable. This is a really special, you know, asset that we have, a cultural asset. It's our history, it's our wealth, and it deserves protecting and revitalizing. I mean, shotguns aren't just old and inconvenient. You can bring them back and make them new and fabulous. That's why 18 million people visit the city every year, is to experience our, you know, experience of food, get their drink on, listen to music. But it's all done in this incredible historic setting. So we're dedicated to preserving it. We have lots of fun house tours, classes, and we help low-income, modern-income people with home repairs through our grant programs. So I encourage everybody to check us out.
I know this is America. You can do what you want with your property. But one thing that just angers me, and I should say, first of all, it encourages me, just people need to get around and drive around what's going on in old Algiers and on Chapatula Street and everywhere else to see the renovation of houses that are going on. But when I see these Airbnbs, and they scream Airbnb, you know what they are. They're cosmopolitan. They have no personality, no nothing. It's strictly put them up as fast as you can with as many, the least features that you can, just to make it someplace for people to stay. How much of a problem is that, Danielle?
It's been a huge problem. It has led to dramatic property rises in some of our more historic neighborhoods, like the Treme, and that has pushed people out of their homes. But it's a catch-22, Tommy, you know, because we all like enjoying higher property values, you know? If we go to sell our house, we want to get as much as we can. And so it's a challenge to balance, you know, the Airbnb situation. I will agree with you, though, when they are developed strictly to be mini hotels, so many of our historic houses are just stripped of their original elements that make them so special. Those things are tossed in a dumpster. You know, gray paint goes up on the walls and all the character is lost. And so it's a real shame and it's a problem. And I'm glad that the city council is, you know, continuing to look at Airbnbs as you know, a problem in our city, but figure out a way to manage it, because it does, you know, it can work well for people when it's done right. And when, you know, homes are lovingly cared for, it's done, you know, for a little extra income or something like that. But when people from out of state come in and just buy up a bunch of houses and turn basically a block into a hotel, that's not fair to the people who have lived there for generations.
I can't define it. It's kind of like the old thing with the Supreme Court and pornography, Danielle. I can't describe it to you, but I can drive down the street and I can point one out to you. You know what I'm saying, right?
You know when you see it.
You know it when you yeah. see it, absolutely. Let's talk about a camelback. Somebody texted in and you mentioned camelback. What's a camelback?
A camelback is basically just a second floor that goes on top of a shotgun, and it doesn't extend typically all the way to the front, but it does get close to the front line of the first floor. And it's a second floor to provide more living space, because a lot of times shotguns can be smaller houses. And so camelbacking a house, some camelbacks are original. So I live in a 1905 single shotgun with an original camelback, and it was actually developed when it was first built in 1905 as a separate apartment. So when we renovated our house, we turned it into bedrooms for our family. Mm-hmm. But camelbacks can be original. A lot of them are new. It's a way for people to keep a historic house intact, but get a little bit more space so that, you know, they don't have to move or leave their neighborhood as their family's growing or as they need more space in their home.
Somebody texted in taking me to task for saying Danielle instead of Danielle. Am I doing the wrong thing there or not, Danielle?
Danielle? No, Danielle is correct. You got it.
All right,
don't worry.
I don't know. People complain about everything. Lord only knows that's all they can complain about. When it comes to somebody texting in about buying a home and buying a home that's old and renovating it, how do you know what to keep? How do you know what to get rid of? How would you go about even beginning to know what's valuable when it comes to Cypress or what's trash and what's treasure?
We, you know, PRC has tons of resources for that. And so I encourage people to just call us. Just call the PRC. We will walk you through it. We offer classes, too. If you want to get more in-depth, you can, you know, take a class, or you can hire a professional. There are preservation professionals across the city who do this work, and we have a list of them at the PRC, so we're happy to refer you. But a lot of this stuff can be saved, can be brought back to new. And that's one thing I want to stress with the listeners, is just because something is old, maybe it looks ratty, that doesn't mean you should throw it away. It can absolutely be revived in so many cases, and especially if it's something like Cypress that grew in a swamp, you know, has withstood 150 years of hurricanes and humidity. You can bring it back. You can revitalize wood floors, you know, historic bricks. All these sorts of things can be made new again. And so I do encourage people who are conscientious enough to want to save what's original to reach out to us.
Somebody texted in, and were some shotguns built with the lumber of wooden river barges, not practical to get them back upriver for reuse, so they disassembled and the lumber was used to build the houses in New Orleans. Any truth to that, as far as you know, Danielle?
There is truth to that. Yeah, those are called bargeboard houses, mm-hmm. and you can find that when you remove the plaster or the drywall and look underneath, and you can see it's very identifiable when you find houses that were made with bargeboard. And those tend to be more in the downtown neighborhood, so Marigny, Bywater. And those are older, you know, really a lot older homes, really 19th century homes. But that is true. And isn't that such a cool factoid?
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a picture of a raised center hall cottage in the Garden District. Mm-hmm. And it looks like some wainscoting on the porch ceiling, I guess the top of the porch. And then when it comes to window trim and everything else, somebody texted in about the paint colors, what's traditional, what's not, and how did these colors become traditional, or do people just paint them whatever colors they want?
Yeah, so we actually, PRC just published a book about this mm-hmm. last October.
Really?
It's called Painting the Town. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a fabulous book. You got to check it out. We have incredible photography, and we explain all of this. So for a Garden District Center Hall cottage, traditionally it's going to be white because most of those were built in the Greek Revival style. And this came later. This came with the Americans moving from the Northeast down to New Orleans, bringing their Protestant values, valuing the color white as pure and good. And that was really more in the mid-19th century. Before that, it was the Creoles. It was the French, the Spanish, and of course the Africans, the enslaved people and the free people of color who were here with their Catholic values, loving color. So the historic French Quarter, which was our original city, and the early downtown neighborhoods, Treme, Marigny, Bywater, those were vibrantly colorful neighborhoods from the get-go. And they have remained that since. And it is because of that Catholic influence, the African influence of the people who settled those neighborhoods. So those were our original neighborhoods. And as the Americans moved in and developed towards Uptown, they developed the Garden District in Uptown, you started to see more whites, more neutral colors. And today, you know, with the exception of the French Quarter, today people just paint their homes whatever is their fancy. And you can walk into a, you know, Benjamin Moore and pick 10,000 colors, which you couldn't do back in the 1800s. You really were limited to what you could choose. But with the, as I said, with the exception of the French Quarter is the only historic district where historic color is regulated.
Yeah, and matter of fact, I'm getting ready to talk about helm paint and decorating. I can see here on the list, and I know they have a list of Benjamin Moore colors that the View Corée Commission approved, but I'm not trying to make this in a commercial or anything. Tell me more about that book, Paint the Town.
Yeah, so we it's basically an explanation for why New Orleans is such a historically colorful city. And we prove through old watercolor paintings that were used as real estate transaction records at the city's notarial archives. Those are proof that from even the early 1800s, we had a very colorful, vibrant city where our buildings were reds, golds, oranges. And then later, as modern paint became, you know, was developed, lots of greens and blues and those kind of other more exotic colors. It's really a vibrant book. We've got famed Times-Picayune photographer Chris Granger to shoot over 2,000 photographs for the book, and we really had a tough time narrowing it down, but it's just kind of a visual feast. I encourage everybody to check it out.
Right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. I want to talk about how the neighborhoods themselves kind of resemble New Orleans, where diversity, I guess, in a lot of different neighborhoods and also different influences of Spanish and French. And what happened with bungalows when I guess the 40s or the 50s came along and the influence they had on architecture. And a lot of people are texting in. I thought it'd be fun to talk about it. Jordan Fiegel did, too. And it is, because we drive around it every day. And thank you, Danielle, for taking the time that y'all do to preserve all of this, because I don't want to be yeah, I don't want to pick a city and pick on it, but I, you know what I mean? I just don't want to be cosmopolitan.
Yes.
USA, where it's just the plain everyday stuff, house after house after house. 9:36, 24 till 10, talking about New Orleans architecture. Back in a flash, traffic now, WWL. 9:43, 17 till 10. Somebody texted me a quote, a friend from Tennessee Williams. America has only three cities, New York, San Francisco, and New Orleans. Everywhere else is Cleveland. Danielle Del Sol, Executive Director of the Preservation Resource Center, New Orleans. Maybe that's what I was trying to clumsily say before.
You got it. No worries.
Somebody texted in and said, ask you about square-cut nails. Now, whenever somebody texts something like that, of which I'm not aware, I always do a little research to make sure I'm not saying anything dirty on the radio, because sometimes people try to trick you into that. But tell me about the use of square. No, they do. Trust me. And they've caught me a couple of times.
Oh,
but tell me about square nails and their use.
Yeah. So, you know, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, when these homes were being built, just like you couldn't go to Helm Paint and just choose a color, you couldn't go to Home Depot and just buy a bag of nails. You had to actually forge the nails from the metal. And so in some of these older houses, what you'll find in the original construction are, you know, hand-hewn nails. Some of them are square, and you can see that they were actually, you know, forged with, you know, with a hammer and fire, and that's what's holding the houses together, as well as, you know, a lot of these early houses have really beautiful woodworking and the ways that the wood beams lace into each other, that also structurally helps support the properties.
Tell me about this house on Carrollton Avenue that has I guess an oriental look to it. I don't know how to describe it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
With the square columns. Do you know the house I'm talking about? Or a bungalow look, and it's got like a covered carport on the side. At some point, are there different types? Did different areas of the city evolve architecturally and copy trends from other areas in the nation as, say, the 40s and 50s and time progressed?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's why the Garden District had so much Greek Revival architecture is because it was developed in the 1850s, 60s, 70s, and that's why when Greek Revival architecture was so popular. And so absolutely, something like the house you're describing, mm-hmm. maybe more of a one-off. There's also a home on Napoleon Avenue that really has this pagoda roof and very much looks Asian. So mm-hmm. there are Revival styles of different types of houses. You can have a Tudor type house that looks like it should be in Germany or England. We have some Gothic Revival homes across the city, one on Carrollton Avenue that's really gorgeous. And so you have these kind of one-offs, but it is true that different neighborhoods, because they were developed later, I mean, the whole back part of the city wasn't developed until it was drained mm-hmm. and until the technology to drain that part of the city happened. So it was swamp. And so as mid-city and the lakefront neighborhoods were, you know, built later in the city's history, their architecture reflected more of the styles that were prevalent at the time. So Gentilly, mid-city, have a lot of bungalows because they, you know, that was popular in the 1920s and 30s. And the lakefront neighborhoods have a lot of mid-century modern architecture because they were developed and, you know, really came to prominence in the middle of the 20th century. One of my favorite examples is Algiers Point, which we're actually going to be doing a home tour, a spring home tour in Algiers Point, April 5th and 6th, so in two weekends. We encourage you guys all to come out. It's going to be fabulous. But Algiers Point feels so cohesive as a neighborhood mm-hmm. because there was a huge fire in the late 1800s, and it burned much of the neighborhood. But the Algerians were resilient and decided to rebuild quickly. And when they did, you know, they all rebuilt their homes with kind of these East Lake styles, many of them, fanciful, you know, woodworking on the front of their homes. And it was all reflective of that kind of same, those all built kind of at the same time. And so now you're left with a neighborhood that really feels like this moment in time of the late 1800s. And they've kept that preserved today. And it's a really special thing.
It is. For people that have not been to Algiers Point or driven around, I suggest they do it because that's where my dad grew up. That's where, you know, I'm very familiar with the area. Mm. I wish they'd bring back Sussland's Bakery, but that's something else. Somebody texted in, said they live in a 300-year-old center parlor home downriver. Porch ceilings are all sky blue. Interior rooms have always been colors of blue room, pink room, green room, yellow room. With all our problems, mm-hmm. I couldn't see myself living anywhere else. That's what the text says. Is that the same as a center hall cottage, and what is that?
Perhaps, or it could be more of a plantation-style home, you know, like a French colonial-style home, mm-hmm. we call it, kind of like the Pitot House or the Spanish Customs House on Bayou St. John, if you're familiar with those properties. Those were very French West Indies style, where they had large porches and lots of doors and windows to, you know, have breezes coming through the homes. And those were traditionally two-story homes where you would have, you know, the first floor could flood. So you wouldn't keep stuff down there that could get wet. And the living quarters really were on the upper floor. So that might be what they're referring to, but the presence of color on the inside of the house does suggest that, and because it was so old, that also, you know, it was probably a French home or maybe built by a Spaniard, but more likely someone French built that home. And what a beautiful thing that it is surviving today. How cool.
Somebody texted in about the French Quarter and wrought iron and actually more Spanish than French. Talk about that, Danielle, if you would, please.
Yeah, the architecture in the French Quarter really is very Spanish. And the way that the Jackson Square is laid out, having a town square with a church and the seat of government, that was very Spanish. The law of the Indies, or what the Spaniards used, those were the rules the Spaniards used to develop in the New World. And so if you go to Havana, you go to San Juan, you're going to see architecture that looks very similar to what we have in the French Quarter, and the town layout that looks very similar to the French Quarter. And so the French Quarter, you know, original, you know, a lot of the French Quarter burned again and again. And when it was rebuilt under Spanish rule. And so a lot of the building elements that you'll see in the French Quarter are actually Spanish and not French.
When it comes to repurposed materials, somebody wants to know if there's somebody that does that for you if you want to buy a home and save what's in there? Do you have to do it yourself? Because you're talking about taking it apart, Danielle, if I understand correctly, and it's a long text, but what they're asking is brick by brick, cleaning the bricks up, getting them ready to be laid again, Cypress flooring, picking it up panel by panel, refinishing it and reusing those kind of things, right, if you want to be authentic, as well as updating the plumbing to modern day.
Of course, yeah, that's essential. And you can also, a lot of environmental, you know, green things like solar panels, certain types of insulation. So a lot of that stuff can be compatible with historic homes as well. So we encourage people to modernize the homes as long as it doesn't damage the historic materials. A lot of times you don't have to take things apart to fix them. You know, there might be a brick wall. You're not going to take the brick wall apart. You're going to do tuck pointing. So you're going to, you might scrape out all the mortar, replace the mortar, make sure the bricks are solid. And if they are, you're going to leave them in place. So it just depends. But the key, Tommy, is to find a contractor who really does have experience working on historic homes, because a lot of people claim to have experience and they don't. And that's when we saw that so much after Katrina, especially, that people just had their homes, you know, destroyed by people who didn't know how to use historic materials, ruined the historic materials, maybe pulled out stuff they didn't need to pull out. You know, plaster walls are incredible. If you have them, keep them forever. They don't let mold grow. They can get wet. They'll dry out. You don't need to rip it out like you do drywall. So there's stuff about these historic houses that you need to find an expert who really knows. And there are plenty of contractors and tradespeople in the city who do know, but there's plenty who don't. So make sure you vet your whoever's working on your house very carefully.
I'm not going to embarrass myself and tell you how old I was when I realized that there was a way beside sheetrock to put up walls with the, what do you call it, lathe and plaster and all that, and I didn't realize it.
Yeah.
But real quick, when it comes to houses with so-called basements, I remember somebody had a house in old Algiers that had one of these. How prevalent was that where they would build the house raised and they would call it a basement, but it was actually, like you're saying, either parking or extra area in case the house flooded? And let me piggyback real quick. I took a picture of a TV shot a while back where every house in the neighborhood was flooded except for the one that was raised, and that's why they built houses that were raised back in the day. Talk about the prevalence of these so-called basements, et cetera, and how common are they, and do people keep them when they buy a house with those?
Yeah, so raised basement homes, there's plenty of them around the city, and you will see them, again, more in the homes that were built in the 20th century, maybe early 20th century, so you're going to see them in Broadmoor, you're going to see them in Mid-City. Of course, you'll see them all over the city, but they're really more prevalent in neighborhoods like that that were developed in the early 20th century. And the thing is that raised basement homes were, just like you said, they were developed so that, like those French West Indies style houses, the first floor could flood, but that's okay because, you know, you only used it for storage or you parked down there or, you know, whatever. And you lived on the upper floors. The problem comes in modern day, when we want to, you know, monetize every square inch of our house, and so to return these raised basements, which typically only have like 7 or 8 foot ceiling heights, we've turned them into apartments or, you know, living spaces, workspaces, and guess what? They're going to flood, and that's going to cause real problems. So insurance companies are really raising the red flag and telling some people, listen, if you want us to insure your house, you cannot use that raised basement as living space or as an apartment because that is not insurable.
30 seconds left, Danielle. Tell me something people can look for as they drive around the city.
Look for the colors and just admire the creativity of our citizens and our friends here in New Orleans. I mean, we have these incredible buildings that were built by our ancestors hundreds of years ago. We're keeping them strong, but we're also displaying our, you know, individuality with colors and plants, and the way we decorate our homes is really, it really makes me love this city so much to see how people care for and decorate their homes.
And it's a shame to drive around and not appreciate it. Quickly, website for the Preservation Resource Center.
PUCNO.org.
Thank you. Have a great day, Danielle. Appreciate it. We'll be back in a flash. WWL.